Welcome to The Mutable Mindset. Join hosts Kevin Logan Jr. and Adam Posner as we uncover the captivating human element within the Web3 and blockchain technology space. Go beyond the trends and developments as we dive deep into the personal journeys, motivations, and expertise of the visionaries who are forging the future of the digital world. Tune in and be inspired by the passion, creativity, and resilience that drives these pioneers. Let their stories fuel your own curiosity and spark the desire to be part of this revolutionary movement. Welcome to the ultimate Web3 storytelling experience. Stay curious, my friends.
Hey, what's up, everybody? We are back on The Immutable Mindset with Kevin and Adam. And before we jump into this week's episode with artist, physical and NFT artist extraordinaire Blake Jameson, Kevin and I are fresh off the plane, literally fresh off the plane from Austin from Consensus 2023. Hopefully we caught up on a little sleep this weekend. It was incredible. We're going to give you our brief recap. So Kevin, real quick hot take before I go through kind of my things here, like off the cuff, what's Kevin thinking about Consensus?
What I thought about Consensus, I mentioned this in a previous post, but what I thought about it was composability. So it feels much more like everybody understands that we're all in this together. It's not necessarily we're all going to make it, but if we don't all come together and figure out a way to steward us forward, then none of us are going to make it.
Nope.
Everything is, lots of things are going offshore. We see, you know, they're kind of in the fight you stage. So it was nice to meet people that understand that. It felt like things are more composable. People are collaborating more and people are more willing to work together for a more perfect future. That's what I know.
Yeah, I love it. And I wrote a couple of my thoughts down. I'm just going to share with the audience here. And, you know, first and foremost, you know, Kevin's out in Seattle. I'm here in New York. So to be able to spend time a couple times a year was insanely invaluable. We bonded, we broed out, we broke bread, had a couple of drinks, had some fun. But really, it was about spending time together and laying the groundwork for the future. But probably nothing talent in the Immutable Mindset podcast. And for me, I was inspired and optimistic. There was many builders and got to see some real use cases and ask a lot of questions and play not just the newbie card, because I don't think I'm a newbie anymore, but to really start to ask questions with a much better understanding than I was a year ago. Another key takeaway for me was the deep connection. So many meaningful conversations, and Kevin and I spoke about this. Yes, when you walk around a convention center, you're going to have those quick intros. You need to ascertain if something's worthwhile. But once you figure out if something is worthwhile, to go deep. So inch wide, a mile deep on these real meaningful conversations. Kevin, were there any conversations that really stood out to you? I'm sure there were, but like what were something that...
There were so many. And you know why? You hit it on the head, a mile deep. The conversations I were getting into with people were talking about real problems that were happening. I had conversations with people about recruitment strategies in Africa. I had talks with people about documentaries that were being created in South America so that those people could understand why we're doing everything we're doing, why borderless payments are important, why remittance payments, why the transactional portion of this technology is important. So I was having a lot of not just surface level conversations, which oftentimes you get at these type of events, but just real deep goosebump raising conversations where people are interested in solving real people's problems with this technology. It was really awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the NFT side too, there were creators there. We met real artists. We met some of the biggest artists in the industry that are creating not just the art itself, but they're creating the ecosystem, the community and brands, and almost like internal agencies where they're working with these brands on how to create for them. It's really cool conversations with some big time folks. We'll recap that a little bit further. Changemakers, a lot of talk still around diversity and inclusion. Yes, it was a bro fest for sure. I saw it on the airplane, but compared to every conference that I've been to, I'm not gonna say bro fest, because when I walked that conference floor, there was a lot of females out there, more than any other conference that I've been to. And it was classy. People were behaving well, everything that I saw, and there was real good vibes. You're shaking your head over there.
Yeah, it just really felt like a professional environment.
Right.
You know, I just came from ETH Denver kind of, you know, a couple months ago. That was cool, but it was spread out. It had this Web3 feel. It had this it had this kind of, I don't know, just kind of just yo-yo feel. Like it didn't feel, you didn't have this feeling like we were represented as diversely as we are in the inclusion part. This was one of those that exactly, when you got on the floor, you saw just a bunch of colors, a bunch of different, you know, creeds and places that people are coming from. It was a lot more inspiring from that standpoint in terms of we're all in this together from a global standpoint,
right,
than most conferences I've been to.
Yeah, I mean, it was intense. And I'm going to expound upon this in a little bit later. It's draining. It's mentally draining to be emotionally engaged in every conversation, to keep it up over the course of 3 or 4 days. On top of that, the physicality of walking around cities, walking around the giant convention center. Listen, we partied because that's what you do and it's fun. And you know what? There's no sugarcoating it. That's how you interact a lot. So, you know, just to kind of sum it up from my perspective, you know, Kevin and I are not just recruiters. And I think that's something we took away, that we provide so much value to our clients and potential clients to really partner with them because we understand the space. And personally, I'm insanely bullish and optimistic and about the future of both Web3 and our commitment as a team and the product we put together, both from a recruiting standpoint and this podcast. And we cannot wait for the insane number of incredible guests that we got coming up over the course of the next 12 months that already want to be on our show. Kevin, any closing thoughts before we kick it over to Blake Jameson?
Yeah, the most important thing and the takeaway that we wanted to ascertain from going there was what this job market's like, what this crypto market's like, what this Web3 market was like. And I think we got our answer. We can still remain optimistic AF because the builders are still here. The pioneers are still building the infrastructure and the players are coming in and making it all make sense for the masses. So again, adopt the next one. Don't think about the billion and we'll get there little by little.
I love it. So sit back, tune up, and get involved with Blake Jameson on episode 12 of The Immutable Mindset. Enjoy, everybody.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to The Immutable Mindset. Today, we have a true creative powerhouse joining us, an artist who has risen through the ranks to become a household name in the world of sports, entertainment, and now the ever-evolving landscape of digital art. Born in San Francisco, Blake has been compared to the likes of Shepard Fairey and Alec Monopoly. With a passion for drawing that began at the tender age of 4, his journey to professional artistry has taken a unique path. Coming from a creative household, his parents encouraged Blake to study art, but he chose to pursue economics at UC Davis, later working in a digital marketing firm, a range of clients from Fortune 500 companies to startups. However, on his 30th birthday, he decided it was time for a change. And following a trip to Barcelona, Spain, he was inspired by the city's rich street art culture to make that change. Upon returning to the U.S., he set up his first art studio in the Rustic Barn in Marin County, which we've just found out he's continuing to work on, where he's honed his craft, creating vibrant portraits and experimenting with mixed media. His big break came during a trip to Las Vegas, where he met former NFL player and current NFL manager Jared Fazen, who encouraged him to paint for professional athletes. Since then, he's become the premier painter, portrait artist for NFL athletes, and has made a name for himself in other professional sports. And to end here, in 2020, he began working with Topps, redesigning iconic baseball cards for Project 2020, and later launched his solo set, Topps 1951 by Blake Jameson, and is currently working on Project 70. His art can be found in the collections of celebrities like Howie Mandel, Gary Vaynerchuk, and Rick Harrison, as well as over 250 professional athletes across various leagues. His work is also featured in an international private collection spanning Spain, Canada, Dubai, Australia, and Switzerland. Please, everybody, give Blake a warm welcome to the exceptionally talented Blake Jameson. I kind of messed up a little bit there,
I think,
but I did my best to edify you.
Great. You got the point across.
Blake Jameson, this is your life.
Yeah.
Good.
Welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, welcome to the show. Blake, you know, now that I have done an extensive intro and kind of brought us up to speed and the audience a bit up to speed on who you are and why you're here, I'd love to go back to the childhood. Mm-hmm. Let's start there. Can you share any specific moments or experiences from your childhood growing up in that creative household with your parents where you felt like you were truly ignited, or was there a moment that truly ignited that passion for art?
I don't think that there's any like single moment as a kid, but I think that I was always drawn to different types of creativity. So I really liked, like, I would wear costumes to school just because I thought it was more fun than wearing regular clothes. Yeah, I mean, like I said, it wasn't anything specific. And like you mentioned in the intro, you know, my parents are very, very supportive of my creative endeavors and have been since I was a kid. And so when it was time to go to school, they were encouraging me to explore studying art or art history or something that would be more creative than the path I chose of economics. But, you know, society's kind of stigma of like the starving artist is pretty pervasive. And for a young, you know, I was 17, 18 or whatever when choosing my college. And yeah, I was scared. So got into what I thought was like a more safe and like, I guess, serious career path in digital marketing. It was pretty good timing because social media was just starting to kind of take off for businesses. Businesses were starting to use Facebook. Facebook started to roll out advertising. And I was kind of on the cutting, on the front edge of that. And so my first job in tech was with Zynga, which was a pretty big gaming company in San Francisco. And it was cool because Zynga is a, you know, it's a gaming company and it's a lot of cool art. And so it didn't allow, I wasn't making art per se, but I was doing kind of marketing, but trying to do it in creative ways that still stimulated me creatively.
So given that you grew up in that creative household and that you're kind of trying to figure out your way, you know, and like a lot of us that are creatives and artists, we don't think that we can truly make a living on that art. Who were you listening to or who was in your ear to help you out? Since it sounds like it was your parents that were encouraging you to go the art route, who might have been encouraging you to go the other route, the more traditional route?
I mean, I would just say like society as a whole. And that was just like I don't know. I feel like I have not really expensive taste, but like I like nice things. And I've known, you know, from when I was a kid, like if I wanted money, I needed to work for it. And so, you know, I was very heavy in the lemonade stand enterprise. Yeah, I don't know. So I think that economics was just like, to me, just seemed like a safe bet. It was fine. I have no regrets, but I wasn't a very good economics student. And the things that I learned in those classes, I mean, they got me to where I'm at. So that is what it is. But I didn't feel like anything that I like learned in school, I was like, ooh, I'm applying this in my job. It didn't really matter.
Yeah. Blake, out of curiosity, I come from a home. My dad is an artist. We've had this conversation. I have the pleasure to hang out with you a couple of times. We know each other. My dad was an artist. He, a professional artist, design background, went to Pratt and everything. So I grew up in a creative household. May I ask, what did your parents do for a living? It's always interesting when I meet artists because I love to hear about their home life.
Yeah. So for most of my childhood, it was only my dad that worked. My mom did a little bit of retail to chip in, but my dad is a computer programmer. And they met.
Yeah, I saw he created your website, right?
He did, yes. Nice. Yeah, shout out Dad. There. Yeah, so my dad studied film and photography. My mom was also involved in like drama. And so they met at like the after party for like a play. I guess it was in college. And so my dad was like pursuing creative outlets. And then they like got together and got married and had me pretty quickly. And so that obviously like changes priorities for parents, new parents. And so before I was entering kind of the internet web 2.0 age of social media stuff, web 1.0 was just coming out. And so my dad saw that opportunity and got one of those giant encyclopedia style books on C++ and started to learn and teach himself how to code.
Comes full circle.
Yeah. So he...
So they get it, right? They get it. They get what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And they're still... I mean, so supportive. The house that I'm sitting in right now, taking this interview, is there is the same house I grew up in. I've returned home.
And how do you think that, you know, seeing that experience of seeing your dad just pick up a book and figure it out, you know, in terms of yourself, right? Going the traditional digital marketing route, but realizing like that's not really where, you know, where you need to be. And then in the words of Matt Higgins, burning the boats and realizing that art is the way. How did maybe that, you know, seeing your dad go through that or seeing him just figure it out, inspire or maybe help shape your ability to do that? Or do you think it did?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it was actually pretty recently that I had kind of this revelation. We have this like 2-acre property here in Marin, and both my parents live here. There's a second, like a guest house, which my grandma lives in, who is actually the owner of this property. And we have a really cool setup. You know, my sister lives five minutes down the street. She's got two kids. So I'm getting to be fun uncle. I'm back home with my parents.
Funkle.
Exactly. And so, you know, I just came back from New York pretty recently. And then realizing, like, I thought that coming here was going to be this stepping stone of like, well, I'll land here. I'll get my bearings back in California. And then I will branch off again on my own, which, you know, is what we do as people. But as soon as I got here and I kind of realized that like this property, this land has everything that I need and want, and all the people, you know, that I care most about, all in one little place.
Amazing.
And so I just had this kind of like overwhelming sense of gratitude that my parents figured out a cheat code in life where they could end up right here, right now, where they've got, you know, my mom's here, she's got her grandkids, she's got her, you know, friends. And so I was just, you know, talking to my dad and just saying like, man, you guys really kind of figured it out. Like, good job for you guys. And thank you for what I interpreted as kind of stepping back and like sacrificing maybe like creative pursuits in favor of like something that's going to be more like reliable.
Wholesome.
So, and his response surprised me because he's like, well, it just like changed the type of art that I was doing, and still explained that like to him, like learning to code and building things with ones and zeros is not that far off from like using a paint and canvas. It's just a different 100%. Medium. And so I thought that was fun. And that was a conversation that happened just in the last few months since I've been back here from New York. So yeah.
It's meant to be, man.
Inspiring.
It's gotta be powerful being in that environment. Like, just, you know, honestly, you describing that environment and what, like, I have goosebumps right now. Man, that's a dream, right? To have the whole family together.
That communal, to be in tribal vibe.
Right? That communal, exactly. Everybody helping everybody. I feel like, you know, putting your art studio in that space in a rustic barn, that's quite a unique choice, right?
From Brooklyn, right?
How do you
going from that Brooklyn right, to that, man? Brooklyn,
right?
I mean, Brooklyn was like a pit stop in my adventure of life, all things considered. Like, I've always been considered myself a California kid, even when I didn't live in California. But yeah, man, I mean, I try not to take it for granted, because I know that the situation that I've like ended up in, and a lot of it doesn't have to do with me at all. It's just like being born into the right family at the right time, and them giving me the right opportunities. I just feel really fortunate.
So as we're, you know, when we were just meeting each other for the first time, Adam cued you in terms of what you're building out there in the barn and kind of what you're doing in Marin County right now. Have you noticed, as you've been developing that, you're mentioning you're putting more soundproofing, which has been messing with the Wi-Fi, but as you've been adding character to the space, as you've been making it your own, has that affected the evolution of your artistic style? Has anything changed about that? Or is this just a process to continue doing what you do?
Yeah, good question. Only recently did I kind of come to this understanding that creating the spaces where creativity happens. So whether, you know, building out a studio space is really something that's awesome, like really fulfilling to me. And arguably, I've had this kind of internal dialogue of like, man, I kind of feel like building the spaces that are like conduits for creativity is more purpose driven than just creating a piece of art itself. And so that's like really, it's fun. And it's something that I've been doing ever since I've started like making art, is finding these spaces and then making this nook into like this little spot that'll inspire me. And I tell people about like you think about the room that you guys are in, or that I'm in, that listeners are in, or whatever. There's like thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of songs playing in that room at that time. All types of genres of music, gospel, rap, country, like anything, right? Yeah. Reggae, whatever. But we can't hear it unless we take a tool like a radio and we tune it right to the right frequency. And then all of a sudden, oh, we're locked in on this classic rock. And now we can hear it. We're aware of it. And so in that case, like the radio didn't make that song appear in the room, but it allowed you to tap into it. And so I think about like creativity as that like radio dial, and being in different environments will kind of tune you to a little bit different dial that will pull out different inspiration and different creativity than other spaces could.
And out of pure curiosity, as someone who's an avid follower of your Instagram stories, how's the gardening journey going, man? Like therapeutic, creativity, nurturing, how has that contributed to your artistic and entrepreneurial mindset?
Yeah, big in that space. Yeah.
It's awesome, man. Yeah. So, and I'll back up a little bit. So, we have this 2-acre property, which has, since it's been in the family since 1968, it has always been horse property. There was at one point 10 horses that my grandparents boarded, and that was like their side hustle, really. My grandpa was a plumber, but they raised
horses.
So we have all this land where for 50 years, it's been getting nothing but like fertilizer via horse poop.
Nurturing,
which is cool. So when our
rich soil,
our last horse, he was almost as old as me, he was 35 years old, and he passed away I guess around Christmas time. And so we had had all these like horse fences up, and I had this idea for my grandma, who was very attached to that horse. I said, why don't we plant a tree in Spook's paddock? We'll call it Spook's tree. And she liked that idea. And then I kind of meditated on it more. I slept on it. And then I woke up the next day and I was like, grandma, I think we should do a whole entire garden, and we should take the whole pasture behind the barn, where it's basically, it's like a horseshoe shape kind of that wraps around the barn where my studio is at the very end of it. And let's start planting it. And she said, that sounds great.
Love it. Thanks for sharing, man.
Yeah, I do. And I want to pick up on that story right there. And it reminded me of something as I was researching you. You are somebody that it seems like will have an idea and run with it. And you are that artist that understands that when you have that creative thought, you have to do it at that moment or it might flee. It might flee. And I say that, you know, in terms of the garden that you produced here and then the tree and doing that for your grandma. You went to Joshua Tree mm-hmm. for a vacation. Mm-hmm. And at that vacation, you saw a cactus and a bubble. Mm-hmm. Do you mind telling the audience the story and what's come about out of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yes, to answer your question, like to touch on that, like I try to stay open-minded to whatever the universe throws at me idea-wise. And if something really kind of sticks, I do kind of try and go and do something that'll get that momentum going. And so, like you mentioned, I was in Joshua Tree, I guess it was like 2 years ago now. So it was 2021, and I was sitting in this beautiful property, and they had all these barrel cactuses on this patio. And for those that don't know, barrel cactuses, like they look like a bowling ball, basically, with just the barbs. Very pretty cactus, but also very sharp, you know, and tough. You don't want to run into it in the dark.
Nope.
And so I was just, it was kind of windy. It was like a nice summer day. And I was sitting out there blowing bubbles because the host who had brought me had brought bubbles for everyone. It's just a fun, like, party favor. And I'm blowing it and it keeps hitting this cactus. Pop, blow it, pop, blow it, pop. And then I blow one and it just perfectly, the wind just catches it where it just lands right on the prick of this cactus. And it just like so delicately balanced there. And when that happened, I had this like vision kind of flash in my mind where it was like bubbles and cactus were like the two unlikely best friends of the desert.
I freaking love it.
And I'll back up a little. I've wanted to make a children's book ever since that I've had it become an uncle, because the kids love books and it's fun to read to them. And I just thought, man, how cool would it be if I could read something that I wrote? And, you know, working in art, and especially in NFTs, actually, like I had learned that I didn't need to make everything that I produced. Production itself could be working with artists and helping facilitate, you know, a creative idea. And so I found this illustrator, this young kid in Mexico, 20 years old, really cool style, very approachable illustrations, cartoons. And so I sent him a bunch of reference photos of the actual cactus and the bubbles and explain the idea. And it was perfect. The match that he came back with was like the vision that I had in my head. So for the last 2 years, we've been working together to develop a whole slew of children's books. And now it's looking, with this kind of multimedia studio that we were talking about, I actually plan to do puppet shows. And nice. I think that's awesome. Something that I just...
I might have to take a road trip with the kids.
Yes. It's going to be... I'm going to have it set up to like film them really nice.
So, you know, interesting to that. And so you had that moment where you were like, oh, I have this idea. So this was one of the last things I heard about you when I was researching you. And it gave me an immediate idea. And I was like, oh my gosh, he has these two nephews. It'd be really interesting if he created this book into an NFT, made the characters into NFTs, gave those NFTs to his nephews. And then maybe you started, you know, again, this is just an idea. I'm not pushing you to that. But, you know, you consider turning the book into a communitized NFT project where the owners are the characters, right? They have input in the direction of future books. Maybe they get airdropped those books if they have a lot of input into the direction. But like when you said the idea, I was like, oh my God, this is an awesome NFT project. Thoughts?
Yeah, I have explored ways to make Bubbles and Cactus some type of Web3 project. And
nice.
I have, you know, the book illustrations itself. I also had basically a 10K generative project made with those characters. So it's the Bubbles and Cactus character, but then we have all the different facial expressions and hat, cowboy hat, neck, you know, and different expressions and things. So I had that. I've been sitting on that for like a year, but as you guys know, the market has been, it's been a wild couple years in NFTs for me, but especially over the last year, I just felt like I just kept waiting for something to kind of click back into place. And then it was like, oh, FTX blows up. Oh, this thing happens. Oh, this is a scam. Like, man, I appreciate Web3 tech and what it can do for artists and what it has done, right, for a ton of artists, including myself. But it's still like a very, very new space. And part of me is, I don't want to pigeonhole Bubbles and Cactus into only a Web3 children's book concept. I want to have the traditional children's books.
Actual book.
As well as like other modern assets like NFTs that would go with it.
That makes total sense. And yeah, I certainly understand, especially from what's happened and a lot of the sentiment in the market. This is probably not the best time to be announcing Web3 NFT projects with that. And it's the same as like big brands, right? Like we talk about this, me and Adam, big brands aren't out here. They're probably working on Web3 and blockchain, but this is not a time when you're going to be announcing that stuff. So no, that makes total sense. And in terms of, you know, NFTs and kind of the digital art aspect of things, one of the, again, interesting things in terms of researching your background was your collaboration with Topps. And then, you know, for me personally, as an athlete and somebody that used to open up more card boxes than I'd like to admit, sorry, mom, you worked on Project 2020 and Project 70, which allowed you to really reimagine baseball cards of in themselves, especially when it comes to digital art. And it's some of the coolest, I had no idea about this. So I'm saying this like real time. When I saw the art on this card, oh my gosh, guys, if you have not seen it and you were ever a collector as a kid, you've never seen better art on a card. It's freaking amazing. Like,
thank you.
Oh my gosh. Like, seriously.
Let me jump in on that one, Kevin. So I'm a diehard Mets fan. 4 feet away from me, right over there in my office, I have my Touche Stadium seats right there.
This is true.
And I live and die by the Mets. The Mets are my team. It's my, after, sometimes before my wife and kids. No, I'm kidding. Wife, kids, Mets. Yeah, you get it. So again, big fan of Blake's Instagram. And I saw on one of the slides, it caught my eye by a second because it was never an official card, but it was one of those moments in baseball, especially if you're a Mets fan. Take it back to 1999. It was an extra inning game. I think it was like a 14 inning game. Bobby Valentine was a coach of the Mets at the time. Bobby Valentine gets kicked out of the game in like the 13th or 14th inning. It's late. It's like a September game, I think it was. This guy goes back into the clubhouse. Bobby Valentine comes back out into the dugout wearing a black Mets t-shirt, a black Mets hat, and a mustache and sunglasses on. It is like a quintessential, like if you're a Mets fan, that moment just sticks in your head for many reasons. One, because it just reminds you that it's just a fucking game. It's just a game. And reminds you to laugh and not take things seriously. So when I saw that card come up, I literally have chills talking about it. I'm like, Blake, I got to get a copy of it. So fast forward a week ago, Blake has these mystery boxes that he's sending out. And I didn't open my full box yet, but by the time this video comes, we'll put that video out there. But I had to open it to take out the one card. And in there, and Blake, thank you so much. Like, it's going to go on my wall right over here. Is that card in a sealed, thick plastic case? And I'm so thankful to have this piece of memorabilia that it's the Mets and someone I deeply admire and respect coming together. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And I'll share that picture with everybody when the show airs.
Yeah, man. So thank you for the support.
The Immutable Mindset is proudly supported by Meta Intro, the professional resume wallet for Web3. The multi-chain custodial wallet holds proof of employment, proof of skill, proof of education, replacing the old PDF resume. Adjacent to the project, Meta Intro runs a massive Discord community dedicated to Web3 jobs. Around 4,000 opportunities are posted in the community every month. For more information on Meta Intro, head to www.metaintro.com. That's metaintro.com, or follow us on Twitter at Meta Intro. Thanks. So here's the question, though. How the hell does that image and that card come up in the conversation of doing the project? Like, how's like, all right, we don't have an official card of this, but that was a moment in baseball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I started with Topps in 2020, like you mentioned, with a set called Project 2020. And that had 20 different artists that Topps recruited, me being one of them. And then they gave us 20 iconic baseball cards, most of which were rookie cards from a lot of the kind of the legends of the league, mm-hmm. right? And so there was very, in the grand scheme of things, a little bit of creative freedom because they said you're painting, or not just painting, you're making cards, remixes, right, for these 20 players using these 20 reference images. And so beyond that, you could play with it. But the follow-up set to that as a group artist set was called Project 70, which was last year. And the main difference in Project 70 was they let the artists choose their own subjects as well as their own reference images. And so we did have to get...
Oh, that's awesome.
We did have to get it cleared by Topps. And so there were a few players that Topps did not have the license to. For example, I wanted to do a Michael Jordan baseball card, which would have been really fun, but Upper Deck has the rights for that. Anyways, so when that set came out, at first I felt like I was kind of playing it safe. I was like, oh, I'm going to do Mike Trout and Bryce Harper and these guys that are going to sell well because I am a commercial artist and I want to make money.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, you got to sell it.
I got a couple under my belt and I was like, man, why would I just like play it safe and do what Topps just had me do? Why not do something totally different? And so my dad and I grew up going to baseball games here in the Bay Area. We had season tickets to the Oakland A's. For a while in my childhood, we moved to Florida and then we were going to spring training games, with Texas Rangers, yeah, Sarasota, and Bobby was there. And, you know, when I was a kid, my dad bought all of the cards, which was junk wax era. I was born in 85. So yep. Starting in 85, he just started buying
my basement, man.
Two of everything and just setting the sets aside, being like, this is college fund, which I think a lot of parents did. But despite the fact that like they were never really worth that much unless you got like the Frank Thomas no name is a really expensive card from that decade. But regardless, like there's really not very many. But we pulled them back out and we started going through like the memory box, both of cards as well as like photographs from spring training and stuff. And there we found a picture of Bobby Valentine holding me as I believe I was like 5 years old.
Oh, no shit.
And kind of like upside down. He's like, you know, doing one of those like thing, you know, just playing with a kid.
No way.
You know, it's just so pure, like the happiness and the fun there. And then my dad was saying how nice of a guy Bobby was. And yeah. And so that kind of that inspired it. And then I started doing some research and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do the players that I have the most context with just to have some for myself. And Bobby was one of them. And then I start looking up, you know, stories and I didn't remember because I grew up an A's fan and didn't follow the Mets that much. I didn't know about that moment until I was like an adult and you know, doing the research for the cards. And then I'm like, oh my God, that's freaking amazing. And yeah, just the picture, you know, just so funny. He looks like Magnum PI.
Just sitting on the bench, kind of just like hunched back there. Wait, so dude, that story is great, but what was it like actually meeting Mike Trout a couple weeks ago and giving him the cards? Was that like a full circle moment?
No, that was Ski that met Trout.
Oh, that was Ski. Sorry. I thought that.
Yeah, yes. No, that's okay. Scott's great. But yeah, another artist. I did see, and I wouldn't have any idea who you're talking about, except I had seen that and I saw that whole interaction.
Sorry about that.
That's really cool. No, another one though that I had met that was also from childhood was Brooks Robinson. And Brooks was at that point, I think he was like coaching at spring training or something, or like one of the, facilitators or whatever. And so he had already like had a very prolific career. And I had remembered my dad always talked about his magic glove because nothing could get by him. And one day after spring training, my dad offered to drive him back to his hotel, which was near our house in Florida. And so my dad's driving, Brooks is sitting in the front seat. I'm sitting in the back seat with Brooks's gear bag. And we get there and my dad turns around and suddenly he's super embarrassed because I'm like, I've got the bag open and I'm just digging through, pulling stuff out, just, you know, and he's like, Blake, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm looking for the magic glove. And I don't know whether or not I found the glove, but the other funny part of the story that like embarrassed my dad at the time, because he was like, let's see. So if I was like 5 or 6, he was like early 30s. So he's young. He was younger than I am right now. And I said, oh, my dad wears the same underwear, and pulled out these like tighty whities out of the bag. And my dad's like, oh God, this guy's like a, you know, a legendary baseball player. And I'm here like, you know, driving him home. And my son's pulling out his underwear.
Oh man.
So that was fun too. And we have this photo where I'm standing in front of Brooks and I'm holding a ball up that I assume he had signed or given to me. And so we ended up making that image, which is a photo that my dad took as like a chase card. And that's the only painting of my Topps art that's actually hanging in my parents' house is this Brooks Robinson card where my dad took the reference photo. Yeah. And it just has fun stories. Yeah,
that's the fun stuff.
Well, I think
I think you've redeemed yourself since then. I think everything's okay. I think your dad is cool with all that at this point.
All right, story time. Story
time. Both
time's
of those
over.
Guys too. I've been able to contact Brooks and Bobby and send them some cards for them to keep that I made, and then they sent some back that are signed, which is cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's so awesome. Oh my God, it's a pretty cool job. I gotta say, you have a pretty cool job there, Blake. You know, and when I was looking at the Topps project, and again, it's because I'm a degen, so excuse me, but like really, like the art, it's so modern, it's so fresh. It felt like it just really gives me, and I know because we just talked about it, it gives me an NFT vibe. It gives me a lot of these newer artists that are coming in with just using. I don't know. I'm not the most experienced with art. I don't know all the words, the mediums, and all this, but it just feels like you use different mediums, you use different ways. You know, when considering at least the technology itself, and have you come across any specific projects or ideas that have sparked your interest? Because when I saw Topps, like I was like, oh my God, like that oven itself seems like it's like a 10,000 PFP project. But just curious in terms of the technology and you using different mediums, new landscapes, have you seen anything that's made you? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that like in terms of the creation of art, I've always been drawn to very analog stuff. I like to use my hands. I like to build stuff that I can touch and feel and smell and whatever. So when I got recruited to the Topps thing, it wasn't really a question in my mind where like whichever cards I was going to be designing, I was going to first be painting them with paint on canvas and making a thing. And then I would photograph that, take that digital image, give that to Topps where it gets resized and printed as a small card. And that was like pretty rare that from like the 20 artists that they recruited for Project 2020, I think maybe 5 of the 20 were making like a physical artworks. Like JK5 was, Ermsy was, Gregory Siff was, but like a lot of the artists were doing it digitally. And there's pros and cons to both. Like digitally is nice because there's an undo button. You know, you can't be sitting there on a canvas and be like, you know what, I'm just going to go back 5 steps and just see if I can take it a different direction, which is fun sometimes and sometimes not. So I think that like it introduced me to new ways of doing it digitally, but not that I would do it, just like appreciating what other people are doing, right? And I alluded to earlier with the bubbles and cactus stuff of how Topps kind of taught me how delegation or basically being like creative director can be just as creatively fulfilling as being the creator of something. And so then I started to meet digital artists, you know, with these other Topps cards and did some collaborations there and also just like tapped into that network where I hadn't been aware of yet or at least like informed about.
That makes sense. Now, in terms of, you know, your story and your art and just kind of, you know, everything that you've accomplished, you met Jared Fazin while working at Topps?
No, this was long
was that before.
It was long before.
This was
Topps.
Long before.
And in fact, when I met Jared 2017, 2018, my focus was making art for offices. And so I had left my career in marketing and I had worked in marketing and like kind of PR. And so like the marketing agencies, the PR firms, those were just like the people that I knew. And so I was like, I was just trying to do it out of convenience, right? Okay, that's
right,
my niche.
Network.
My niche is the people I already know. And so I was doing art for offices and did some really cool projects that I'm really proud of. And I think that if I had not met Jared and kind of pivoted into the sports, I think that I could have done very well in that niche too. Because the difference of like, if you're dealing with an artist, like I was focusing on companies that had moved out of a co-working space into their first office, probably raised a Series A, and then they just had a budget for art and culture. And I figured if I could get in front of the right people that have this money that they have to spend on art that's not their own money, I'm going to have an easier time selling them the things that I was making. And so that's what I did for a while. But then when I met Jared, he was like, dude, your stuff is awesome. You should paint for athletes. And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, I think it's awesome too. And I think I should too, but how do I do that? And he's like, oh, well, I can introduce you and do a couple of these guys for free. And then you're going to get your foot in the door. And I didn't have a ton going on at the time. So I'm always down to prove to work for free a little bit. And so I did that. And very quickly, it was apparent that that was going to be a good niche for me. And I was getting a lot of referral work. And I enjoyed sports. I played sports as a kid. So it just seemed to make sense. But You know, it wasn't until, I guess, 2 years after that of just painting athletes and painting. That's like the 250 number that you had said. That was about like, that's when Topps found me.
I think it's important to for people out there who just look at some of these top artists like yourselves and like the journey. Like, how did you get to this point, right? Like, you didn't just all of a sudden, you know, you're on the scene painting for Topps. You paid your dues, hours, thousands of hours in the studio, creating, working for free, proving yourself, trying, experimenting. Shit just doesn't happen overnight. And I think that's kind of one of the things about the NFT space where these people are like instant successes, instant millionaires because of marketing and pyramids and schemes versus the real, like when NFT started, just in my opinion, it was the one-of-one art, like those one-offs, like the real art about it. And then it got bastardized by those bastards who rug pulled us all.
I'd love to add to that because that reminds me, that's such a freaking great point. And you spoke about this in your story, right? You have a digital marketing background. There's often this conflict between the artist and then the salesperson, right? You're an artist and you're like, how the hell do I sell? So you went through this process, you mentioned like 6 months of just the art process, like not knowing if you could sell, how am I going to sell? But then you tapped into that digital marketing background. Luckily you had that background. And to me, it was exactly what you would think about in marketing. When you were creating the art, you were trying to find out where your art landed, and you found out that it landed at offices. And that's how you were able to then strategize. That's such an interesting way to think about it. And it's what the artists usually are missing is that marketing and sales piece. I found that so smart. And again, obviously you have that background, but you used it. But can you just talk about that conflict that artists have when it comes to the sales marketing piece? And you know, you take in that 6 months and then just to bring that forward, you end up selling your 10 pieces within like an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was like pretty early on working in marketing and working for all these different businesses. It was very clear to me that from the clients that I worked with, the ones that were successful all knew exactly who their customer was and what kind of what they were providing for that customer. And so they could lock in. And the companies that I come in, they want to market their thing. Who's your customer? Everyone's our customer. Oh, what do you offer them? All these things, you know, people have a difficult time focusing. And so I knew that I needed to pick like a niche. And like you said, like I pulled basically where my art was going. And that's kind of how I landed in that office niche, which was cool. And then with Jared, I mean, I think that the work within the sports niche was, I don't know, I'm even more proud of. So like at first it was like, it's a numbers game. And I had a business in college where I would literally knock on doors and I would ask them if they wanted a paint job on their house, house painting. And if they did, then I would take their information and I would go and give them an estimate and then hire people and paint their house. And so like, I just knew from that, well, life is a numbers game. You just got to ask enough people. And like, some people are going to say yes. And so I just started Twitter and Instagram DMing every single NFL athlete that I could get a hold of and showing them the first couple that I had done, which were Jared's clients. And I would say something like, hey, you know, I'm a portrait artist for professional athletes. I just did this one for CJ Anderson. And if you ever need a painting, I'm your guy. And then, you know, out of 100 messages I send, I might get 10 responses. And of those 10, some people would say, awesome, you know, how much? Some would just say like, yeah, here, like, you know, you can do this. And if I tried to say it was going to cost money, then they'd say like, oh, I don't want to pay money for that. But it was like, regardless, like it was just, I'd have at bats, right? And I'd have some shots. And at first I thought that doing paintings just for like exposure was something I was willing to do. Instagram was popping, you know, if the guys would post an Instagram story, sometimes they might, or a post, you know, they could have millions of followers and that could be customers. And I thought it was like really cool and personal to have their addresses where I'm like, ooh, I'm mailing Antonio Brown his painting to his house, you know, or whatever. And I like took pride in that, but I couldn't tell people, like even people were like, oh, what's their address? Where do they live? I'm like, I'm not going to fucking tell you. Private, right? And so then it like clicked for me one day where somebody had me mail a painting to their training facility. And then at training facilities, the staff will open packages for the athletes to like make sure it's not,
right,
I don't know, stalker shit or some, I don't know, something dangerous. And so they like open and vet the mail. And then they put the mail into the lockers for these players. And NFL lockers, I have since found out, are generally pretty standard size. And so I figured out the biggest size painting that would fit in an NFL locker. and be sitting kind of underneath their jersey so that they would come into the locker room and they would have a painting. And I would target two or three guys. And this was like over a lot of A-B testing and like planning this, but I would find two or three players who were good players, a lot of like got playing time, well-respected, but not the superstars. And in fact, like not usually not even on the cusp of being a superstar, like maybe a promising rookie or sophomore or something, young guy. And I would hit them up and say, hey, I did these painting. You know, this is what I do. If I do a painting for you for free, will you post about it on social media? And when I would say that, if they would respond, they would almost always say yes. Now, whether I could actually get them to post was a different story. There's definitely some attrition there.
Yeah, right.
But I would
forgetfulness, convenient forgetfulness.
Yeah. And so then I would do all three of those kind of mid-tier players on that one team, all, and they would all be on the same team. I do them all at the same time. I would ship them all at the same time, but in separate boxes.
Right.
And then so sometimes I woke up to text messages where it was a photo of like lockers in a locker room where like two or three of them each had a painting in it. And the guy's like, well, how do I get one? Like these guys both have one, right?
Demand,
and
they're
both,
create the demand.
And they're all competitive.
Smart.
By nature. So like one guy gets a painting and the next guy's like, well, I want a bigger one. You know. I want
that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's a great way. It's a great way to start a bidding war.
Yeah. People love dogs. People love dogs.
Yeah,
absolutely. Final question. I'd love to bring the sports world and the art world together and wrap this up in a way that we can maybe provide some actionable advice to our audience. So we are the Immutable Mindset. We are a Web3 NFT blockchain show. NFTs are providing a new way for younger artists to monetize their art. In the same way that NIL does, name, image, likeness, right? It's allowing younger athletes to monetize their art in a way they never have before either. How do you see the parallel evolution impacting the future of creative expression in sports? And what challenges or opportunities might arise as a result? Because I know you have two nephews, right? Are they asking you about this stuff? Are they curious about this stuff?
They're too young for, like, they're 7 and 4. So they're not at the understanding NFT. They're not asking about NFTs yet. I mean, I think that it's interesting. I think that like Web3 is this wonderful toolkit of potential that I think that like we've really only kind of tapped that like very, very, very minimally scratched the surface. And we've seen these different kind of cycles and different types of projects doing well. And like I started on Super Rare. I got introduced by Micah Johnson, who made Aku. He was a baseball player and I had interviewed him on a baseball and art podcast. And he was like, you got to get into crypto art. This was in 2020, during Project 2020. And he's like, I don't know what crypto art is, but he explained it. And I was like, well, that sounds like something I could just add on top of what I'm already doing and like maybe make more money. So he introduced me to Super Rare and I got on there and I started selling one of ones. And after a little bit of like learning the market, I started to sell more. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like artists by nature are creative people. And so we see problems differently, we see opportunities differently. And so it's just so fun to see how artists capitalize on different opportunities and how what they create from it.
Are you seeing any new capitalization? Are you seeing artists capitalize their artistry in new ways due to this technology? Just curious.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that like from the most basic standpoint of like an artist like myself who's tapping into their existing archives that we've already like made money from, but hopefully like selling those paintings, right? And now we're using these digital images and repurposing that art into a new way to monetize. And so that was cool to be a part of an experience. And then also like getting into like generative art, right? And these bigger collections. Mm-hmm. I remember when I started, when it clicked in my head of like the Bored Apes, which I passed on, silly, but I was like, I don't get silly, it. Like, silly. why would I want... Like I literally like passed up getting a bunch of Bored Apes so that I could go and buy like one or two one of ones from these obscure artists from that, like, you know, they just didn't do anything. And I was spending like one ETH for a piece or two ETH or whatever. It felt like Monopoly money to me because I was making it by selling my own art. And then I would want to go out and just like keep it in that ecosystem. But I totally like misread that opportunity. It was like the one of ones, this is where it's going to be. And then Bored Apes really took off. But like, I just remember going through and then cycling and looking at all the images and being like, oh, I get how they did that. Oh, cool. The nose is like a different layer. Ooh, the fur, like that process was like, it's so it's it, like now it's like, oh, of course that's how they do that. But like when I'm first dissecting it and looking at it, I'm like, how do they do that? That was like really interesting and fascinating to me. And I think opened the door to myself learning how to delegate and like project manage and creative direct, which eventually brought me to Knights of DGen, which has a 10K, well, 8,888 PFD collection. And yeah, I mean, it was a fun challenge. And like, I can see now, you know, at this point, Knights coming up on 2 years in October. And yep. So it's been a long time. And oftentimes I will do a piece of art. I will love it. I'll think it's the best thing that I've ever made. And then I reflect back on it, you know, a year or two later. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. I'm proud that I made that then, but it's not my best work. Right. And so I can see, like, I learned a lot doing the generative art for the first time with Knights of DGen. Some of the layers didn't line up right. I had like just little things that for me as a perfectionist artist and not knowing how to do generative art beforehand, I was like, oh, well, okay, now I know. And then we did the Steeds collection, followed that up last year. And I feel like the art was a lot cleaner, a lot like I just felt a lot better about, okay, now I know how to do generative art. But yeah,
it's all learning, it's all an evolution.
That's the plight of the artist. You gotta dive right in, jump right in. Perfect. Really appreciate you breaking that down, Blake, really do. So we are almost at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. And before we end, I do like to take notes kind of as we're going through and give some takeaways, actionable advice to the audience based on our conversation we had. So just some notes for some of the conversation we had today. First, embrace your unique path. Blake's journey to becoming a successful artist was not a linear one. His background in economics and digital marketing played an essential role in shaping his artistic career. Remember that your unique experience and skills will contribute to your success. Two, pursue those passions. When Blake decided to make a change on his 30th birthday, he chose to follow his passion for art. He burned the boats and went for it. Go for it. Don't be scared. Be open to chance encounters. Blake's connection, we talked about Jared Faison, right? Met a gentleman. That gentleman connected him with other people that wanted to breathe his art and understand it. That led him to more. And all of a sudden, he made a career out of art. Be open to chance encounters. Adapt and innovate. Blake's exploration of NFTs and communitized art projects showcases his willingness to adapt. It's an ever-changing art landscape, and you need to be following the trends and stay on board. We just talked about that. And then lastly, share your story. I'll say this, Blake's upcoming children's book demonstrates the power of storytelling to me. You went on a vacation, you had a thought, you had a creation, and then now you're putting it in place. Share your story, it matters. Reflect on your own journey and passions and consider how you'll integrate them into your career and your personal projects. I think this is a masterclass in that, Blake. It was absolutely a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, Blake. I really do appreciate it.
I want to add in two things.
Please. To that. Please.
I think
please
that something like all of that I agree with, but I think that one of the missing pieces for me at least was number one, like you have to be super clear about what you want. And this could be professionally or just in life in general, but like you have to decide, because if you don't have this goal like laid out and kind of detailed, well, where do I like, what kind of life do I want to live? How do I want to spend my day? Who do I want to be around? Spending time on that, I think, is really useful time. And then the other thing that like, after you kind of have that figured out, ask for what you want. And that's just something that so many people miss, is they just don't ask.
Got it.
And sometimes that's physically asking, saying, hey, I need help. I need this thing. I need this support. But it's also like for me, and I'm getting goosebumps now saying this, it's asking
me too. Me too.
Right. It's asking the universe. You decide, okay, I want to live on this. I want to remodel this barn and I want to build this creative sanctuary that's going to attract world-class artists from all over the world so that I can just continue to create something new every single day. Right. It's crystal clear. Now I go to the universe and say, okay, that's what I want. Show me what to do. And it will give me the ideas and it will show me how to do it. And it doesn't mean that I know exactly how to do it right. And I know how to go in like this music studio. Like I've torn down these walls and rebuilt them up to make them like very soundproof several times because I'm like learning as I go, right? But I'm still like, I've gotten really good at asking for what I want from the people that I love and from the universe. And that I think is something that differentiates me from people that's like, it's not even a difference. It's just a choice of like, I just ask. And then it's easier
just
to get
ask,
the things you
just
want.
Ask.
And if you're not a creator or artist listening and you're not inspired and motivated by that, man, I don't know what that goosebumps, still goosebumps. Blake, again, thank you. Please let the people know where to find you on socials. And I know that you guys are going live on the, is the garden live?
Yeah. So the Hideaway Garden one, we're going to wait where we won't release with this episode. I thought,
okay.
And just to like give you guys a little bit of I'm trying to figure out a Web3 angle for my gardening. And part of the gardening that's so
nice,
the attraction to it is that it's not commercial. I can't just go and sell a plant, right? Mm-hmm. The joy is watching it grow and be different every day. So I'm trying to figure out a way. And I've got a couple advisors, Drew actually being one of them, of like bouncing ideas. But I kind of jumped the shark a little bit when I was like, this is going to be live by the time our show comes out, because the truth is I'm still figuring out what that angle is.
It's all an iteration. It's all an iteration, yeah. Man.
So the best way to find me is on Twitter. It's just my name, Blake Jameson. You can find me on Instagram that way too, even though my handle is Athlete Portraits. And then my website is blake.art.
You're lucky you got awesome. That one.
Perfect.
Yeah, well, I'm still holding out for blake.com. I'm trying to get it. Every year I make offers on it, and this guy that has it doesn't even use it, which pisses me off. But blake.art is an amazing one. But everyone's like I'll tell people my email address, blake@blake.art, and they're like, oh, cool, .com.
No.
blake@blake.art.com. I'm like, no, just that. And so it does provide some confusion sometimes.
Nah, that makes total sense. That makes total sense. All right. And to wrap up the show, and to everybody listening at home, we greatly, greatly appreciate you. If you enjoyed what you heard today, tell a friend about us. Take 15 seconds. Leave a comment. It helps us out, and we really appreciate it. I greatly appreciate you again, Blake, for joining us on The Immutable Mindset. Please follow us on all our social media channels at Immutable Show. Subscribe, comment, and network. Thanks for joining us. Catch us next week for more. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to The Immutable Mindset. We appreciate you for joining us. Please follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Immutable Show. Subscribe, comment, and network. And catch us next week for more. Take care, folks.